This is Brain Inspired, powered by The Transmitter. Hey, it's me again. I'm on dry land. I hope that you are somewhere. So this is the second conversation I had while teamed up with Gaute Einvall at a workshop on neuro-AI in Norway called Validating Models. How would success in neuro-AI look like? Gaute creates his own podcast called Theoretical Neuroscience. Go listen to it. I link to it in the show notes, along with a handful of other relevant links to the good people you're about to hear. That's at braininspired.co/podcast/196. Thank you for supporting Brain Inspired, and thank you to The Transmitter. And we are back. We're still on a boat. I'm here with Gaute Einvall again. We still have our, what is it, sea legs? Is that what they're called?
Absolutely. I think we all sort of after, when we got off the boat, right, we were sort of like a little bit, it's interesting because our, what they call vestibular system, balance system is sort of a little bit out of whack.
Yeah.
So we feel that even back on land, we still have some oscillations.
Yeah, I was, that last day we had another couple sessions or one last session in a conference room off the boat, and I was a chair of one of the panels and moderated some things, and I was standing up there sort of swaying still, you know, so that was fun. Yeah. Okay, so in the last episode you heard from Andreas Tolias and Ken Harris. In this episode, Gaute and I had a conversation with Christina Savin or Savin and Tim Vogels. At the end of our conversation, we'll sort of wrap things up with Mikael again, who helped organize. He and Conrad Kurding helped organize this workshop. So I'll just start by saying we're not going to give huge introductions here, but Christina gave a talk and researches more the theoretical side. So she's right up your alley, Gaute, for your theoretical neuroscience podcast. But she uses recurrent neural networks to study how learning works in a very theoretically driven way. And do you want to say something about Tim?
Yeah, no, so Tim has been working on synaptic plasticity for many years. So I know, some of his work back from when he worked with Wolfram Gelsnit, who has sort of educated many of the people working on synaptic plasticity in Europe. So there he did some really interesting work, I think, on how sort of networks sort of gets into this balanced state by self-tuning and by sort of inhibitory plasticity. And now he's sort of using these AI tools sort of to, or at least optimization tools to sort of to not just... Well, actually explore the whole space of possible synaptic plasticity rules.
Yeah.
So that was sort of, but it's really, his group in Austria is doing really excellent work, I think, when it comes to exploring synaptic plasticity in its many facets.
I think even more so than the first one, the audio quality in this is sort of in and out. There's a lot more creaking and noises. Yeah. This was in the night and the sea was angry. Evening, it seems.
So it's actually, when I talk to the people on the boat about it, so say this because we pass Folla, so it's like a well-known sort of stretch of ocean where it sort of often gets rough. He said, oh, it's only going to last only an hour or two, they said, and then, true.
Thankfully, our discussion didn't get rough.
No, so that's, no, it didn't. So it was a little bit, it was also late in the night, so that was also, another reason for bumpiness, maybe,
All right. Anyway, final thoughts. This was just an excellent workshop, excellent amount of people, excellent people. Yeah. It was just a lot of fun, and I learned a lot.
Actually, and like in a final comment there, because when I asked Mikkel, because I think what people really liked, was a wide variety of people there. They had really different backgrounds. And also one of Mikkel's worries, as he mentions, I think, was that people were not going to able to communicate, have some common ground to sort of to discuss. But that was not the case at all. And interestingly, he also said that some of the people he invited was actually had heard on your Brain Inspired podcast that got sort of. So maybe that's also you can take some credit for the excellent selection of researchers who was invited on this.
Thankfully, I can take credit instead of be at fault.
Yeah.
Because it worked out well.
That's true. Absolutely.
Okay, enjoy our second discussion here.
We're going to ask you some general questions, or many questions, and what about the relationship with neuro and AI. And we're going to start being a bit personal. It's a bit late in the evening, and the boat is waving even more than it when we did the other recording. So, but anyway, so in what sense has neuro AI changed the way you ask questions or do your science?
Kristen, you want to start?
I can go first. I would say that we were doing conceptually what we're now doing with neuro AI many years before the term was invented. So, like, there are different flavors of neuro AI. So there's the, like, we kept talking about it throughout the week. So there's the AI to neuro in data science terms and in theory terms. And there's the other way around. And we do a little bit of everything. But before there was AI, there was machine learning, and we did exactly the same things with a different set of tools. So from my perspective, our fundamental structure of our approach hasn't really changed, but the tools have gotten better.
But how about for you in particular, you personally, on a personal level?
This is specifically about the research that we do in my group.
Maybe you should just briefly mention what your research in the group is.
So my group is sort of like fundamentally interested in understanding principles of computation in the context of adaptive behavior. And we're interested in sort of like normative / mechanistic interpretations. So we make circuit level models of learning, of memory, of task-dependent adaptation, attention, things like that.
So with normative, you mean that you ask, how is this helpful for the animal? Is that what
you mean
by normative?
Yes, exactly. So normative, we mean that we think that these are fundamental computation for the animals, and so they, through evolution, development, etc., they've been optimized to do them well. So then looking at the machine learning optimal solution of the same kind of problems should give us indication about the essence of the computation that the brain has to do. And I think that it's really important for those computations to be like very important for the animal. This wouldn't happen for everything, but that's kind of the approach.
But deep learning itself has not, you're saying that the machine learning tools that existed before deep learning were sufficient for what you do?
I'm saying that the structure of the approach, how we ask this kind of question, hasn't changed. So before deep learning, we would formalize our normative descriptions of the task in probabilistic terms, and you would use tools from Bayesian machine learning to like say what the optimal solution looks like and sort of like try to make the maps to circuit function.
Bayesian machine learning, that's sort of like finding some using machine learning techniques to help to find this probabilistic functions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as I said, like the tool, like we have more tools and we have more powerful tools, but we like the way we approach the questions hasn't really fundamentally changed.
I think I would agree with that.
Wait a second.
This is for what we do in my group. I'm not saying that this is a general statement. But.
What about you, Tim?
Based on your talk, I was thinking that you would have a different answer.
No, I think...
What about, maybe this is for the listeners, so we should... What was
that's
his
what
talk
the,
about?
That's what the introduction is for.
Okay. That's
no, you want to just give a brief roundup of what that...
So my lab is similarly interested in circuit dynamics and the interaction between network-level activity and plasticity rules. So how do plastic synapses change the dynamics, and how do the dynamics change the synapses?
Yeah.
And I think I spent a lot of my time as a PhD student and as a postdoc tuning spiking networks at times for months. and now I don't have to do that anymore, I guess in part because I'm not the one doing the programming, but also in part because the tuning part is being taken over by machine learning methods. So how does AI change the way I approach a question? I don't think about how painful the tuning is going to be anymore.
Parameter fitting.
Yeah.
Looking back, does that feel silly that you spent that much time, or was that a valuable
I think it was valuable. I think actually I had a blast doing it. It was frustrating, but it was also rewarding. And I don't regret having tuned for 6 months because.
But also, I mean, when I remember one of the papers that you wrote with Henning Spreklet and also in the group of Wolfram Gerstner, yeah, was this really cool thing where, like, inhibitory plasticity
does the tuning for
does
you.
Does the tuning for so
that came out of this.
Yeah, but that was so this sort of if you had the good AI tools then, maybe you wouldn't have thought about this.
No, I think I still would have thought about it.
Okay.
But we may not have hand-tuned the rule.
Okay. Yeah.
And I think we so would have still... Like
that. So it didn't really... The absence of AI didn't help you to prevent...
I don't think so. No. I think there's other ways. You asked the other question, how has AI negatively affected your...
I was about to just go ahead and bring that up because, yeah, I thought, go ahead. You're going to answer it anyway, so...
I think there is a... There's a push, there's some pressure to use ML tools as a scientist. And if you don't, you're not considered interesting. So,
but is that ML tools or is that specifically like deep learning?
I don't think it has to be deep learning. I think it has to be some flavor of large amounts of compute. So if you don't agree?
No.
I think if you don't put in your CV somewhere that you've used 600,000 hours of CPU time, you're not available.
I don't put that on my CV. That's bullshit.
And I'm saying this facetiously, but yeah, there's truth to that.
So now I know why I haven't gotten the grants lately. Yeah. This has not been my CV.
I do think that the community has gotten more machine-like in the sense that it's driven by fashions and sort of like particular brands of deep learning have become fashionable and it's easy to publish certain things and very difficult to publish things with other tools. But for me, the consequence of this fashion-driven research enterprise has been a reduction in the entropy of our approaches.
I agree. And there are some people that are, there are some people in our community that are very clearly very deep thinkers and very, theoretically minded scientists that are our seniors that wouldn't get a job today because they're not using ML.
In a reduction in entropy of your problem, meaning that there's more things.
I don't think there is one way of doing research that solves all of the questions. I think that there is strength in diversity in the community for the approaches because for different kind of questions, certain different approaches are better or sort of like make more sense. And it's also sort of longer term. We want to preserve knowledge about lots of different ways in which to do things because they might become relevant again. Like one of the things that I learned when I was in undergrad from one of my professors, I did computer science as an undergraduate, was about this sort of like really old ways of doing like memory storage.
They made you learn this?
Yeah, like we had to learn this in school. And it's like, okay, like why are we learning how... undergrad, sorry.
She studied in Romania, so she's a hardcore...
Hardcore.
We had to learn this in kindergarten.
It was sort of like we were learning in the computer science classes in undergraduate about the history of different operating systems and how they handled like memory things and things like that. That was like, okay, but we have better computers. We know how to do this better. Why are we learning these things? Right. And the moment when mobile phones came on, which had very different resource constraints, all of these old tricks that were completely irrelevant for a number of years became all of a sudden like super relevant or super important again. And I think this is the kind of thing that we also want sort of like as a community of scientists, we want to explore sufficiently many different things that like to be able to like do sort of like long-term selection that this crossbreeding of ideas. If everybody like is, it's an echo chamber, everybody thinks exactly the same way, we have lost something really fundamental about the process of doing science.
I think there used to be a period about 10 years ago or so that there was a bit of a snobbery towards people that were purely numerical. And that has flipped, and now there is a snobbery towards people that are not purely numerical, so that just theory will simply not get you there.
Well, neither of those are healthy.
No, clearly.
That's exactly the point. Entropy is the answer.
Exactly. Many approaches.
Yeah. Hmm.
Actually, also in physics, it used to be that people who just do too much numerics, they were like number crunchers and not real sort of
thing. Not theorists, like, right? No, exactly. Yeah. Are you a theoritical physicist? Are you even a physicist?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But one thing that, in your talk, you have used machine learning as a tool to explore the space of possible parameters that could tune the plasticity, right?
And,
you were alluding to that earlier as well, but for you, it's really just changed the way you approach things, but as a tool.
Well, like my students can do things that I would have never been able to do. They maneuver vast landscapes of parameters that I could only dream of.
Right.
And they have the means to not only just travel through them, but actually find meaningful combinations. And that's just...
That's the whole point, right? It's because you got to explore such a large landscape of possible combinations of parameters, you found the ones that actually work. And the backstory of this, of course, is that there's a... I'm just going to repeat the term. I know it's said over and over. There's a zoo of quote-unquote plasticity rules in terms of... the duration between pre and post spikes that then lead to strengthening or weakening synapses. And it used to be that, the Bliss and Lomo, sorry, that's a technical sort of very specific thing. That was the rule. But since then, there have been lots of rules that have been found. And what you'd use machine learning for was to explore the capacity, essentially, the possibility of the rule space.
We added another 10,000, basically.
Yeah.
But that, it's sort of interesting. It has some analogy, a bit analogous to sort of like when we used to do like modeling of biophysical detail and biophysically detailed neural modeling, right? Mm-hmm. Then there was only like a handful of models that people used, like Maynes and Ofsky had a few cells, and so we did, so there was like a few cells that everybody used essentially, and suddenly you got this automated ways to make these neural models, right? So you got like the Blue Brain project produced a lot of neural models, and also the Allen Institute, and so suddenly you go from like three or a handful of neural models to like a whole zoo.
200, yeah.
So has it made life more complicated?
I think for morphologically plausible modeling, certainly.
Yeah.
I think choosing what model you want to use has not gotten easier.
But also for you, to in this like this synaptic plasticity rules, right? You showed us.
No, I think for us it's gotten a little easier because we have different questions, but they're certainly more satisfying because when you found a single rule that worked, it was almost certain that you were wrong, and the experiments were incredibly arduous to do, and now that's not. I mean, now we're still wrong, but
you have a space of hypotheses.
Yeah.
I think that's actually one of the good ways of using these more powerful tools that we've inherited from the deep learning revolution, is to explore options that you wouldn't have thought of otherwise.
That are not so expensive to explore as well, right? Time-wise.
Yeah, and it's sort of like practical for a PhD student to do that and get a PhD in a reasonable amount of time.
So what I'm hearing from you both, and I think that everyone in neuroscience would agree, is that the new brand of deep learning, machine learning on steroids and AI, is great as tools.
Yeah.
However, it seems like you both agree that there's something lost in terms of the knowledge of the other spaces of possible solutions to things and approaches.
I don't know if it's lost for us because we already have a job.
Yeah, we're old enough to know these things. But I do worry about sort of like the incoming PhD students who like have been trained, like know how to train a convolutional neural net or whatever, and they know how to run some deep learning autodiff. And they come to their PhD and expect that to be the essence of what...
You do worry about that?
I do worry about that. So it's like we're talking about sort of like negative impacts, I think.
I don't know if we are just old, right? We just sound old.
We're old and grumpy,
younger.
And it's...
We're just saying that you guys are the young investigators.
Yeah, let me finish the thought. So I think there's, like, with really powerful tools, they're as good as you sort of, like, your uses of them are.
Yeah, right.
So, like, it has the potential of making things substantially better, but in the wrong hands, it could, like, also make things much worse. So my worry about sort of like our ability of our students to critically think the use these tools in a reasonable way. So like the focus now for the, like, if you're thinking about a junior person trying to get into this field is like, it's not how you use its tools. Like you can go to the internet and sort of like learn how to do that in a week. That's not the educational component. The educational component is how to think hard about the problems and the use of these tools in a meaningful way. And that's hard. Because the objects are increasingly complicated, so like reasoning about them is hard.
Because I remember this, I read this Linus Pauling. He was the guy who sort of like found the structure protein, right? Yeah. So he said that like when he sort of did this X-ray of this, he had to do so much manually, and it was so many. So he had so much time to think about things. So he was worried that these with the new tools where you get this X-ray spectra out sort of like automatically.
But wasn't it Socrates who said that he worried that writing would make us dumb?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I was just thinking of you sort of from this paper that you mentioned of where you tune this inhibitory plasticity to get to the balanced state, right? So, I mean, in this process of tuning by hand, you thought about it much more.
Yeah, but for the ISP paper, we didn't tune. That was the beautiful thing. It was the paper
ISP,
before.
What is it?
The inhibitory synaptic plasticity paper.
Okay.
We tuned for the balance paper the 2 years before that.
Yeah. Okay. So then you tuned that. But then for the, didn't you learn much about it? Didn't you get like the dynamics of the network under your skin?
I did. Yeah.
So that
and I still do, in fact. And I it's.
But you do that also with the machine learning techniques?
Your students? No, I think my students do.
Yeah, they sort of have like an intimate.
I don't wonder about that.
yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Sort of like I keep thinking about this sort of like this. Was it like an Arthur Clarke quote about any sufficiently advanced technology is not indistinguishable from magic? Kind of comment. I sometimes feel that these sort of like the at least transformers and some of these like really big LLMs and things like that feel like magic to me.
Yeah.
And I wonder how many of the neuroscience users of that technology treat it a little bit like magic, that you're so detached from how it does things, what are its limit cases, what are the things that it could possibly go wrong, then you kind of take for a given that whatever that thing spits out is the truth. So I think that's kind of another thing that we're kind of losing with all of this complexity, that our ability to sanity check the process becomes very, very hard.
So I guess you both say that sort of like the it has improved the methods for doing what you already were interested in some sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, so that's like an improvement of tools. But, and I guess, I mean, these tools will lead to new discovery, hopefully, new discoveries in the future. But do you already have some examples of where it has already changed the way you think about the brain and cognition? Or
But we've been talking about the tools, and but the other side of that is this. This continually growing, people are very excited about sort of using deep learning models as a proxy to model brain areas and understand brain areas and or cognitive functions better. And that's sort of that's a different facet of neuro AI. So that's where I was thinking like, well, has it changed the way that you've thought about how brains function in sort of not from the tool front, but from the using them as models of brain function.
So like when I said normative, we are actually doing that to some extent. And there is one example where I was like, okay, I started my faculty job saying that we're going to do interesting mathematically tractable things and this is going to not be a deep learning lab with sort of like forcefully. And sort of like then students came into the lab and they really, really, really wanted to do it. And sort of like then I had
to do deep learning?
To do deep learning methodology. And we tried to think really hard about how to do that in a way that's not stupid and trivial.
Yeah.
So I couldn't stand by my original statement, but I was pleasantly surprised in a couple of occasions. I think.
They were doing deep learning after you had left for home or something.
But that must be these days. Doesn't every student want to come in and do deep learning these days?
This is the problem, partly. But
not to my lab, I have to say. No, but I do spiking networks. There's
I don't know. Everyone wants to apply it to everything, so I just imagine.
It's going
to
happen sooner or later. But there is one example where sort of like there's a problem that we've been thinking for a very, very long time, and using tools from deep learning to ask those questions gave us qualitatively different solutions. And that's sort of like trying to think about how the brain infers from noisy observation things that are important for, like, latent states in the world that are important to drive behavior. And we and others have a cottage core. Like, there's an entire niche in computational neuroscience, engineering, probabilistic representation. So how would neurons go about encoding beliefs about the state of the world?
You're on that paper with Ralph Hefner.
I'm on, for my sins. It took us, I don't know how many years to write.
Yeah.
yes. But, like, those are sort of like very constructive. Like, me as an experiment, as a theorist, I go about and say, like, how would I go? What do I think are the things that are important? I know math. These, I think, are the things that are important according to math. And this is how maybe I could map them into neurons and neural activity. And in a recent project where we're trying to understand the behavior of animals, making inferences about changes in the context,
we you have to take your hands off this. It's going to keep creaking.
Sorry about that.
Is that what the creaking is?
Yeah.
That's me. So we went a different route because the task was sufficiently complicated that it wasn't obvious how to apply the traditional approach. We tried to train some deep reinforcement learning agents to do the task. And at the level of behavior, so when we're analyzing this recurrent neural network the same way as we do the animals, their behavior looks close to optimal probabilistic. Mm-hmm. But if you open the box and look exactly what they're doing, it's nothing like any of the solutions that we have imagined empirically. So this kind of like taught us a big lesson that this sort of like perfect mathematical elegance in the map to error was to the neural activity was probably a futile endeavor altogether. And that they're kind of this not so obvious ways in which to achieve functionally the same thing. And we wouldn't have ever come up with those kind of solutions on our own without the use of these technologies. But I think those examples are still rare.
But are you thinking, how does a neuron implement backprop? Some people think that, right? Like,
didn't I give a talk about that?
Well, I don't partially. Care at all.
Yeah.
You don't care at all.
No, in terms of finding parameters.
Yeah, no, yeah. I just, like, I'm like, meh.
Yeah.
It doesn't, I don't know.
Well, you need to be agnostic. Sort of like to care about how, if you care about learning at the circuit level, I think you do need to care about how does task-relevant information shape synaptic plasticity in a way to drive behavior towards good states.
Sure.
And backprops with time in this case are mathematical tools to formalize that problem in precise ways.
Because I guess, I mean, you're just, well, in your project, you were just interested in getting at good solutions. So they say, like, in war, love, and optimization, everything is okay.
Yeah.
And not everything is global, right? There's a lot of local learning that is not backprop.
Absolutely. When you talk about biology, right?
Yeah. Carson Stringer just published a paper on the archive that says, like, at least 50% of what they see in terms of learning effects can be explained with local changes and local rules.
But that's a question of what's happened in real brains.
Yeah, exactly. So how is backprop implemented is not that interesting a question for me.
Yeah, so Tony Zader would have totally liked this answer. I still believe that there's a sufficiently large amount of goal-directed learning happening that we need to figure that out. But
yeah, well,
Tony's going to be on my podcast again, so he's been on it before, but I don't know if it'll come out before this chat or after. It depends on how long.
They keep inviting us to the same neuro AI meetings, and they keep putting his talk before mine. So he gives an entire amazing talk about how the brain does very little plasticity, and it's all sort of like evolutionary inductive biases. And then I go say, I'm going to give you a talk about plasticity.
Are you going to that this year? Is this at the end of this month? I was asked to go, and I was like, I don't know.
We've already done a new CL one this year.
So what meeting is this?
It's the Cold Spring Harbor
Spiking Networks. Ironically called Spiking Networks.
No, this is a neuro AI.
There's a neuro AI.
Something subtitled.
Mm. Yeah, subtitled Spiking Networks.
Maybe so. Yeah, there you go. So, but anyway.
Ironically, no Spiking Networks.
So it doesn't sound like, it sounds like you don't give a damn about, no, I'm just kidding. It doesn't sound like you know, like this deep learning revolution has changed the way that you think about brain function?
No, I don't know that it has. I'm still interested in the same things. I'm interested in local changes in plasticity rules and neuromodulated changes to activity that will then produce local changes in plasticity.
I wouldn't say the same. Like for us, so sort of like what's changed is the scale of our ambitions. So yeah, like for sure. With this set of tools, we attempt to understand adaptive behavior of much higher complexity than we would have without it.
But that doesn't speak to like the way that you sort of internally think about how brains function.
No. This is why I said that our methodological approach only has gotten richer, but it's like structurally hasn't changed.
But I mean, you have sort of you are sort of in like what you're doing, like
he's mainly. Pointing at Tim, folks.
What?
Tim. You're saying you.
Yeah, Tim. Tim, you have sort of worked a lot with like with the spiking networks of like integrating fire type, and which is sort of like it's not like multi compartmental modeling, but it's still quite biophysical. Right, and you think the or it's sort of like physical, right? Yeah. I mean, there are real things, thresholds and stuff. So do you think? I mean, do you think that this focus on AI and will sort of actually, I mean, reduce, suppress sort of like the activity? I mean, that's
no,
like,
I don't think so. Look, I mean, that's part of the appeal of, I think, the questions that we're asking in my lab. Is that we're not competing with the big companies. We're not competing with DeepMind and et cetera. You know, they don't give a shit about spiking networks
because that's true.
So far they haven't been proven to be computationally viable. And one of the questions in my talk was, can't you find a function or a task that is actually computationally interesting? All the neuro tasks you have, memorizing something, are totally boring for someone who's doing AI.
But you still have this potential for, I mean, making, providing, well, requiring much less energy. Isn't that the whole idea? But that's
an argument that people make for spiking. Yeah. I don't know. That's making spiking networks the water carrier for big AI.
Yeah.
And that's not my interest. I want to understand how the brain works.
Sure. Mm. Yeah. Cool. So do you think, I mean, we sort of, what about like, how do you see, well, these are exciting times in AI. So how do you see the relationship between AI and neuroscience in the speculate that in the years
long
to come?
Long-term future.
Yeah.
By the way, sorry, Christina, I think you almost got the quote verbatim. It's Arthur C. Clarke. It's any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Sounds like you got it verbatim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I think about that a lot.
Sorry to interrupt.
Thank you. So the future of the interaction between AI and neuroscience, I think that's actually where at the moment where this is like maximally unclear. And one reason for that is
maximum entropy. Isn't that what you like to say?
Yeah, I like we do write papers about maximum entropy models. Okay, so but this is an accidental happening. So on one side, AI is in this phase of young enthusiasm and exuberance. So like you blink and the entire sort of like set of those fanciest architectures, fanciest trick has already changed. Like you can't keep up with the literature. The things change so fast. So it's hard to say what like AI will be about in 6 months' time, not to mention 10 years. So that's kind of a big source of uncertainty because we don't know why, like where that's going. Presumably, like as this thing matures, you're going to see the same kind of things that you see in maturing other fields. So it's going to be less about like changing our mind about how we want to approach this every few months and more about sort of like converging to a set of good solutions and trying to build a foundational understanding of why they work. So we're not there yet, but.
But so you think that this recent exuberance will die down in the next couple of years?
I think we're just going to switch course. I think general artificial intelligence is not far off.
Oh, geez, hot take.
I'm going to not say that.
At least in parts, we're going to have ever more power. Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, so what do you find as general, right? Is creativity included? I don't know that we're going to be useless as humans for a while, because creativity is
not part of your definition of general.
Yeah, I would say, like, transferable skills, fine. Creativity and
I'm not even sure that that's true. I think LLMs do something good, but it's not general intelligence.
But we're closer to it than I think we can project. Like, we can't project 2 years down the road. And so what the relationship is between AI and neuroscience is entirely dependent on how, you know, for the next 2 years, is going to be entirely dependent on how quickly tools from AI are going to become ever more powerful to understand relationships in neural recordings that we can't even fathom yet.
Yeah, I mean, like, we're going to become a users of these technology, that's for sure. But
we already are.
Yeah.
Like, to an even larger scale. Oh. So it's going to be kind of the bread and butter that you need to know how to do these things. But
NLPs are spiking.
I do wonder sort of like what's purpose does basic research in neuroscience serve if you have a functional model of general artificial intelligence? Because sort of like a lot of the original motivations of why we got, like, why I got into this field was, oh, this is the most intelligent system that we know. So if you want to understand principles of intelligence, looking at the brain is like a good idea. But if we have an artificial model of that we're satisfied with to some degree, I think it's not clear exactly how to assess that. But assuming that would be the case, then I think that the computational neuroscience community would have to have some really serious soul searching about what are our questions, what purpose do we serve now, and like what Ken and Andreas were saying earlier about sort of like maybe this becomes more about circuit level and molecular, sort of like going more low level. So systems neuroscience will not have that much of a purpose in basic research terms, but you're going to have to go down to get to the clinical applications part of the process. Might be one way this would play out. That would make me very miserable, and I might have to change fields, but who knows.
But sort of, I mean, one thing that we have seen is, for example, talking about Andreas, that he's sort of been making this foundational models, which are extremely good based on deep networks, extremely good at predicting, like, in a neural activity and neural responses based on visual input. Yeah. And this, but it's difficult to interpret. So this thing of getting increasing predictability and losing. So the older models were sort of not as good at predicting things, but you can sort of think about things like receptive fields and Gabor functions and. So are you more comfortable, maybe? Are you comfortable about sort of having less interpretable models, but more?
I think interpretability is a concern. I think, like, what the modern deep learning tools are providing us, which is kind of going back to the general intelligence discussion, are extremely powerful statistical descriptors of large quantities of data. So there's a very big difference between, like, very good statistical descriptions of a data set and a process model that describes the causal relationships that generated that data. Like, those could be completely different solution classes. So I think ultimately we want to understand how things work, and we need process models. It can't be the end of the story, because it just summarizes exceptionally well a large amount of data.
But it also won't work to replicate what computer science has done, which is to create systems that we then don't really understand.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Our goal is to understand the brain, so it won't help to simply replicate the brain in silico.
Yeah. There's another, like, famous quote that, like, I don't understand what I can't create. But I think, like, the fact that I can create something doesn't necessarily mean that I understand it.
Yeah, so you
the
said converse that, right? Feynman is wrong.
Yeah.
The converse is not true.
It's like a new thing. But also, I think if you have, like, this, say, if you have a biophysical model, the network model, which, of course, is just as complicated as a deep network in some sense. But at least if you're able to make this model predict experiments, then you can start, it's like a white box, you can start playing with it, turning off parameters. So that sense, it's like a beautiful research animal in some sense.
But yeah, a one-to-one map. It is a beautiful research animal. Yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah. A one-to-one map of the world is going to be as...
The world.
The best model of a cat is the cat.
Yeah.
Preferably the same cat.
I don't know. Is it?
Is that Schrodinger? No.
I don't remember who that is, but this is a quote from the very first summer school ever on computational neuroscience that I intended. I keep collecting these.
Someone else. I don't have any good quotes.
I like the other one better with a cat, which goes, science is like looking for a black cat in a dark room, and it's not even a cat. And I think that's what we're asking, right? What's the relationship with AI and between AI and neuroscience? It's not even a cat.
But going back to the original question, what's the future of the relationship between AI and neuroscience? I don't know, but I'm kind of excited to find out.
Yeah.
I think this is going to be fun. Whatever crazy thing
I agree with
happens.
You. Mm.
Do you have an AGI take?
No.
Tim gave his. Christina gave hers.
Yeah, no, I don't. I don't have anything.
Okay.
So it's worthwhile to say about this.
So I think it's telling that we can all three, because I think it's, first of all, I think that we have a misconception of what intelligence is, but we all have a different definition and we have to operationalize it, et cetera, et cetera. But I think this, what I think of AGI is like way far away and we can all three disagree and none of us knows anything.
Yeah.
And that is exciting.
Mm. I should mention that, I mean, I used to do condensed matter physics back in the days before I got, that was a postdoc. I took a PhD and was even not a postdoc doing this. So I switched at a late stage. And of course, this was at a time when sort of, I would say, like, we solved the Schrödinger equation and we sort of, but there was no mystery at the end of the rainbow. And and then you come to neuroscience and we understand so little, but it's fantastic.
There's no rainbow.
You're trying to invent the rainbow.
Yeah. No, I think it's fantastic. Like, at the end of there, somewhere far out there, there's consciousness. Right?
Yeah, sure. There's no rainbow, but there are leprechauns everywhere.
Yeah, I think so.
And that's stars.
But that's fun, though. I agree with Christina. I mean, it's fun that we are. And it's a big privilege to really be at the frontier of this sort of big unknown.
So we already kind of talked about what they believe neuroscience can learn from AI, and that's really in the form of tools, right? I mean, it's just mostly a tool.
I wish there was more the other way around. And like we
what
have
do you mean, that what AI could learn from neuroscience?
Yes. So ways in which knowledge from neuroscience informs architectural choices, for instance, in deep learning or other algorithmic quirks. I think it's sort of like there is a transfer the other way around, but it's kind of subtle and it's not like one thing that made a humongous impact, but it's sort of like in subtle ways it affects a lot of things that are happening in deep learning.
Like what? Like
neurons and attention being the immediate obvious things, but also sort of like the way they approach interpretability of their trained recurrent neural networks is essentially by treating it like a brain in doing neuroscience experiments.
Right.
They do ablation experiments, they do in silico mapping of receptive fields and things like that. So I remember sort of like in earlier days, five years back, when they first start, like deep learning first started to be really, really successful. And I was looking at what they're doing with the networks, trying to understand their properties. Like, haha, you're using experimentalist tools to try to understand something really complicated and failing in exactly the same way as the rest of the neuroscience community.
That hurts
has.
On the inside.
But this is kind of the point, that it's not that there is no flow of information. It's just that it's hard to pinpoint this is one thing that completely made the difference. But in subtle ways, we're influencing how the process works in a lot of ways.
Well, it's not subtle how AI is influencing neuroscience. I mean, someone had to argue that the brain is not a transformer today. You know, like they actually spend a whole talk arguing that, you know, we're not transformers.
Like he stated it. I don't think he was trying to, like, I don't think that was a position difficult to defend.
No, but the fact that it was defended for that period of time.
But there are also neuroscientists who make models for how transformers can be implemented both at the neuron circuit level and at like neural area level. So, yeah.
Yeah. Like we do have models of contextual modulation of visual processing, for instance, that are circuit level models. They're not transformers in the details, but they're transformers in the spirit, in the sense that I have top-down information that decides what kind of things from my input stream is task relevant, what kind of bits are not, and I preferentially transfer the bits that I care about. And the dynamics of that is what we have circuit models for, and like related to actual neural data. So like again, like it's what counts as similar enough, and is it similar in spirit, inspiration, or is similar in spirit like, but not in the details, something to be ignored? I don't know.
I mean, changing topic a little bit. You, Christina, just got tenure. Congratulations.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah,
very good. Yes. Which is sort of like a milestone, obviously, if you want to stay in academia. And you also, I mean, you have a permanent job, but only for a few years.
4 years
now. Exactly. So you're rather newbies in terms of tenure, right? And that also means that, because this question, what does it mean to be productive in science? And from an operational point of view, if you want to stay in academia, sort of being able to qualify, getting tenure is a good thing, right? And you have to be show off with like papers and grants and stuff to get to that. But now you have sort of, at least you have just been for a few weeks, and you have now time to, you can sort of do different things with your career. I mean, you can sort of be involved in many projects and be like spread your thin. And you can
we
be
were always doing that for ever since.
Yeah, exactly.
I think actually the time before tenure for me was probably much more diverse in what I was doing.
Is that because you were trying to find the thing?
No, also I was doing things like the Imbizo or, you know, the summer school in South Africa that I started to co-direct. Or Worldwide Neural. These things were not necessarily directly career relevant, but they were fun and they sort of served as an outlet for what is otherwise a relatively, you know, computational neuroscience doesn't have a direct impact on many things. and those additional hobbies, quote unquote, serve that purpose.
If you're on tenure track American professor, you don't have time to have hobbies. So I did, like, my entire career has been about doing too many things at the same time. And like, that's a bad strategy. They tell you not to do it, but it was sort of like, just happened to me. Like, it's kind of what works with how my brain works. I have lots of spread around interests. I don't care about one thing, but about a range of things. And we had lots of collaborators, so that mushroomed even more projects. So it just happened.
But do you think it actually would? Did you think you did your best? Did you do your best work in that way? Or do you think you now that you can, now you can sort of focus on fewer things?
I find myself being swallowed up by administrative chores. Since I have tenure. So it is now said that the time of the juniors has to be protected. And so here is the administrative load increased.
Oh.
So what I used to spend on the Imbizo, which I have just retired from, or Worldwide Neuro, I now spend on hiring committees and grant committees and all kinds of nonsensical, less... immediately relevant.
Okay.
Well, wait, before, so were you going to ask about productivity?
Yes, let me finish the answer to the question. So basically, because I was putting up my documents for tenure not so long ago, and I was like, had to think retroactively, is like, what it is exactly that we've achieved, where is this going, things like that. There was a lot of soul searching involved. And I think I've came up with the conclusion that doing fewer things better is something that I would like to try in the incoming years. They're practical things, so you can't trim down as much as you want potentially. But
I just wanted to ask, like, immediately, and then we can come back to this, because so what then? What advice would you give to people going in now, given, you know, reflecting on your own? I mean, you know, are you going to say don't do what I did?
No,
I do tell people that on a regular basis, but this is not what I'm going to tell today. So I think sort of like taking the time to find a good question before you jump into doing frantically like things is something that I try to encourage my starting PhD students.
How do you know what a good question is when you don't know anything?
Yes, so this is the second immediate advice that I give to those people, is read literature broadly. Maybe this is like old grumps talking, but I do feel that in graduate school, I spend a good fraction of my time reading papers. And there used to be this sort of like 10 advice, like what plus, what yeah. is that called? Ten rules for blah, blah, blah. And there was a 10 rules for becoming a great writer. And one of those was like, read 10 papers a day. Oh. Like, okay, like nobody can read 10 papers a day. What are you talking about? Like these papers are getting so complicated. It takes you a week to read. But I think a milder version of that advice is very good, that you need to know what the field is about, and people tend to like read very narrowly. So exactly in the niche of what the project is about, but sort of like missing a lot of really important connections because they just don't have.
Of course, now you have two excellent podcasts in the field, right?
Yes.
Brain Inspired.
Yours and who's?
Brain Inspired. Mine, Sorrow,
And ChatGPT.
Chat
can summarize.
That's not a podcast.
but that's kind of a thing, like Tim's new app to summarize.
Yeah. Like what is the new app?
Topotopic,
yeah. Tell us about
it. We can
put
it in the show notes.
I just want to say that the challenge there is because the field has mushroomed a lot more production. So basically there are a lot more papers to read in general. But that's maybe one of the places where deep learning might help, because like if you have summarization tools, like you can get at least a superficial breadth.
And then tweeprints actually are, I think, a hugely interesting way of
tweeprint,
like the preprint on Twitter, you know, or now on Macron.
A summary.
Yeah. Oh. Quick summaries on Twitter. I really enjoy those.
Yeah. Okay. I should maybe start doing those. Yeah.
What would be your advice to
drink? I think drink from the fire hose. I don't know. I really don't know. I find the term work-life balance really problematic, especially for young PIs, but also for grad students and postdocs. I think the only work in your life is that you have to sleep enough. That's the only work time. Everything else is sort of life.
Wait a second. I'm trying to understand this. The work is the...
Sleeping. I find sleeping is my worst chore in the day. I set an alarm clock in the evening so that I go to bed at 12.
Because otherwise you're going to keep working?
Yeah. No, I just keep staying up. I mean, that's really the only thing that I violently dislike in my day, going to bed.
Have you ever tried putting the cocaine away?
No, but I think what would be my advice? Do what you're interested in. Run as hard as you can. Don't take prisoners. Drink from the fire hose. I don't know.
But you think work-life balance has gotten out of control?
I think I'm going to get slaughtered if I say that seriously.
But there's, you know, things can...
I think what is considered work has been has been a little bit corrupted in a way. Because, you know... You can't be at the same time a student and a worker, in my opinion. So you have to sort of decide whether you want to be a graduate student and take on what you get as a privilege of being taught something, or you decide that everything you do after you reach your lab is work. And then, you know, then it's a 9-to-5 job, but you can't have the cake and eat it, I think. So if you decide that you're actually a graduate student or a scholar of some capacity, to whom society gives relatively large amounts of money for very little productivity compared to a baker or a builder or, various other jobs.
Graduate students.
Postdocs and PIs as well.
Get a relatively large amount of money?
I would say so.
Okay, we're from, yeah, all right.
I mean, I certainly got a lot less money than what grad students are getting today.
As a grad student.
Mm-hmm. And
you were in US and you're now working in Austria. So I think it's partially a European US thing, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a life choice you make at the end of the day. And you are going into a field that is A, very competitive, but B, very privileged in that, we're sitting on a ship talking about science.
It's the first time for me that I've been on a boat at a conference.
Yeah, so. Me too. Yeah. Same. Yeah. A friend of mine, Guillaume Lajoie, always says, "I fucking love science," and he fucking loved science always, even when he was being paid very moderately. And that, to keep that in mind, to call that back into your own memory, into your own everyday, that you're not in fact doing something because you're being forced to, but that you're doing it by choice. Is an incredible privilege.
Christina, you look like you're chomping at the bit there.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with this. I think that, like, being in graduate school is very intense and very hard. And if your heart is not really in it and you're doing it as a job, then probably there are better ways of getting the same amount of money with better benefits and better life. So I think sometimes people get into graduate school either as inertia, they were doing well.
That's like maybe 70% of people, I would guess.
Because of this sort of like social pressures that they want the title, but they don't really enjoy the process. And
those are overlapping populations.
There might be, but I kind of feel sad about those people.
You are sort of clearly, well, both extremely motivated and sort of have made it also in the sense you got excellent academic jobs. But I mean, there are also people who sort of, I mean, they're not that, I mean, at full health, they have some like health limitations or maybe like some family obligations. So are you saying that?
Maybe they're just lazy.
Yeah, lazy, I don't.
Pointing a gun to them.
Really? That's a possibility too.
That's an affliction.
Yeah. But, so I mean, there are sort of, should you say, if you cannot put in like...
I'm not saying that you need to work 12 hours a day. I'm just saying that the hours a day that you work, you need to be 100% in it. Yeah. Like that those need to count.
Yeah. Exactly.
Whereas, what's a job that would not apply to?
Most jobs. I mean, most jobs are sort of work from 8 to whatever, 9 to 5. Mm-hmm. And then, like, if you work in a shop or like, maybe like a...
This is not arable, but basically, like, there are plenty of things that you can do at 80% and get away with it. And I don't think you can do science at 80% and get away with it as a career. Like, you might get the PhD that way, but you're not gonna be very successful.
And to be fair, at the postdoc level, I think there is a lot of people who are putting in 100-120%, and they're not getting jobs, and they're not getting invited, and their interviews go poorly, and because the bottleneck is getting a PI position, and that's incredibly tough.
The fire hose that won't turn on. So.
I
say to sort of like people ask me that. Like taking a PhD, sort of, you learn how to program code, whatever. That's a safe investment, regardless. Yeah. But going on a postdoc, maybe that's a little bit. I mean, if you're aiming for academia, that's sort of bottleneck. There are many more postdocs than PI jobs, permanent jobs. Right.
I was ignorant to the cliff that I was standing on when I started my postdocs, and I simply until I had kids, I actually had no. Risk management plan. I was just like,
but you didn't really need to.
No, I didn't need to.
I was young and immortal, and could always do something.
Exactly.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Because I did my PhD in Germany, and the German system treats has a lot more sort of like insight into this because it's so difficult to get a permanent academic position in Germany. People start the PhD. Largely with the expectation they will go into industry and sort of like the transfer work skills and what you're learning being used for lots of different things is kind of like part of a MMO. It's not an afterthought or plan B. It's like the default. And if anything else happens, that's good, but it's not really expected. In the US, we're still sort of like selling the academic path as the default. And everything else is plan B, although the numbers are really not
substantiating that claim.
Like in any way reflecting that. So, yeah.
I'm slightly afraid to ask your productivity question given their this last one.
No, but I mean, the slow productivity thing.
Yeah,
that I talked about. Yeah, I mentioned that. I sort of read this book about slow productivity.
We have just a few more minutes if you guys are good for just a couple more minutes and then we'll
Yeah. So So I read this book on slow productivity, and it's like this. And the basic idea is that it's easy to measure productivity if you're a farmer or producing some industrial things, or but the knowledge work is not so easy to measure, right? And then you get these proxies that many papers or that you look visible and you work a lot, and then you think about it when you sort of read sort of for example about the lifestyle of Darwin, who was sort of like I would say like productive, had a quite productive scientific life. He didn't work that many hours, right? He sort of had like in the morning and then he did some, but it was like this. He was sort of like focusing on a few things and then sort of doing high quality work. So is it something? But I guess you feel pressure to getting grants and have students and this like. Success is often like measured now in sort of how many students you have and how many grants you get in and how many papers you.
Yeah, I need to get enough money for my students to have jobs, like to be able to graduate. Yeah. So there are external pressures. So it's not like you can take your time. I wonder sort of like these historical examples, whether it's fair to make those comparisons. I do think it's the better way of doing science, but the sociology doesn't work. And the reason for that is a lot of the very successful scientists in that period were like independently rich, and they did this as a hobby for fun. So they did it whenever they wanted. They had the time
and the leisure
to do that. And it wasn't sort of like, I need to desperately get some stuff done. Like we're in much more sort of like externally driven.
So how do you think about productivity personally then?
I think Darwin might be an extreme version, but I do think like you actually make better science that way. But
But screw it, we're not in that system anymore. So
the sociology doesn't work, and sort of like until as a culture, as a field, we decide that we are going to change the incentive structure in a way to make that a feasible MO, we're gonna have to do what the external pressures force you to do. Like I can't stop doing certain things. It's just like not gonna work.
So my postdoc advisor, Wolfram Gerstner, when I joined his lab, told me three rules for his lab, or there was four actually, but three big ones: show up in the lab once a day, one paper per year with your name and my name on it. Doesn't matter what positions, and if you want to go to a conference, you have to present your own work. And then on top of it, we couldn't speak anything but English in front of open doors. That was rule number four. But that was it. And I kind of try to propagate this, and I think that's for postdocs a great rule. One paper per year is doable, and not necessarily as a first author, because sometimes they support grad students, but if you're a postdoc for 4 years and you got four papers out of it, that's really productive.
Yeah, but if that's the rule, then it says nothing about the quality of the work.
No, but it does, because one paper per year is not a lot if it doesn't have to be a first author.
But it takes a lot just to write the paper and shape the paper and get the paper out the door. So that in itself is a lot of work. So if your work, so if you're working to get a paper out, that's different than working to answer a question, right? I mean, presumably you would want to be doing both.
But I think you front load with work and then you end up with papers. And so maybe I'm speaking because of confirmational bias, because I was in Wolfram's lab for 4 years and I have four papers.
It worked out.
But you know, this plus minus one seems to work okay also in my lab. The postdocs seem to, you know, they're not slacking off. They're working. And at the end of the day, they're ending with about a paper per year.
But you were doing monkey physiology, which is the hardest thing.
Physiology doesn't work on that time.
And this was a theory lab, right? Yeah. This was a theory lab. Experimental labs are probably
easy.
Structured.
Easy. Yeah. What you do is easy.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not real work.
Yeah. I have to clean monkey cages. I'm used to hard work. Scrape that. Never mind. all right. So actually, I have one more just kind of fun question.
Yeah, please go ahead.
I asked this of them earlier, and that is, how do you know when or if you have a good idea scientifically without doing any work to vet it? You're just, you know, you're in the shower, you're daydreaming, whatever, and you have this idea. How do you know if it's any good?
If it's coming back.
if it's coming like the next day,
yeah.
if you think of it again?
Yeah.
So you don't write it down?
No, I write them down. But I used to write them down religiously.
But then you can just read it and it comes back. So that's so every idea is good. Every idea you write down must be good.
No, no. Now what I usually do is I text them to a student of mine or a postdoc, and then they're like, you're insane. Or you're stupid, more likely. Or they just don't respond because it's...
You're not even wrong.
Yeah. they're busy writing that paper they have to write.
Exactly.
But if it comes back, usually, I think a good idea will avail itself a few, because you, if it's a good idea, you think about it for quite a while.
Yeah.
And then
I sometimes discover, like, my, I look at old notes, like a year before and stuff like that. I was like, oh, I had this idea before. I completely forgot that.
You must write better notes than I do.
I write terrible notes. Otherwise, I would have done it the first time around and I wouldn't wait for a year. No, but for me, it's sort of like, ideas that I find good, and they don't have to be right, they have to be good, is ideas that I'm itching to find the answer. It's like, I keep thinking about it, and I really want to do the numerics right now, I want to do the math right now, I want to talk my student into doing it right now. So I get this sort of like vibe.
Wouldn't it be cool if we could do this?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And it's not that all of the things that we do are like that, but I think what keeps me going is the things that feel like that.
Good. All right, guys, keep going. Thank you for your time. Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Perfect.
It's been fun on the boat, hasn't it?
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
It's been more wiggly than average.
It's been super wiggly right now.
Yeah. Because we're outside, right?
So we're here with Mikael again, the organizer, the brains behind the conference. I know you had help, and Tona and everyone was a great help in putting it together. But all right, so now you've had this thing. What was it, a success? So the title, right? Validating models, what would success look like in neuro AI? And the last thing that I brought up, and the very last thing that we did, was this panel discussion about what would success look like in neuro AI? And there was a wide variety of responses, actually. But so, we've had a lot of great talks and great discussions throughout the trip. So, and Gauti, you can chime in here too, but I just wanted to get your sort of reflection on how you think it went. And so a boat this year, Gauti thinks spaceship next year, outer space.
That is, yeah, sort of top yourself. You have to sort of like space station.
Yeah,
exactly.
There's no arguing against that.
No, so that will also. Yeah.
Next year, we all get our own speedboats and we all have like headsets and screens, we're racing and giving talks. Yeah. Yeah.
So, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
So, what do you think? Was it a success? Was the workshop a success? How are you feeling that it went?
I think it was a great success. I think everyone really enjoyed the conference or the workshop in terms of the scientific material, but also in terms of the kind of social aspect and just the trip has been really great. But in terms of the science, I think there's been, I had two big worries. Like, one would be high winds and waves.
Oh,
and
the weather was great.
Bad weather.
Yeah.
So everyone got seasick. Yeah. That would be terrible, right? Yeah. So that didn't happen. So yes, that's a success. Mm. The second thing I was worried about would be that, all the talks were off target, or that no one would discuss or talk. And, it would be just like another science conference where everyone just gives all their data and there's like impossible to respond to it because there's so much details.
I think this format where you had like first, I mean, everybody had like a 40-minute allocation slot, and then a 20 minutes for presentation and then 20 minutes for discussion.
Mm.
That was very successful, I think.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
That was the right format.
For this meeting, it was perfect.
Mm.
Yeah.
Did you learn anything? Is it going to change the way that you approach anything in your own work? Because I'll start off by saying, like, I made connections and had conversations that gave me new avenues of thinking about my own work.
Mm.
So that's been super valuable to me.
Mm. I mean, so one thing, I mean, with just rethinking about the workshop kind of topic, I think continuing kind of, probing the community and kind of the people doing the science on how we should do it right, I think has been a major kind of insight that this really is an important thing to do, like to ask these critical questions on how kind of, you know, if you take a step back, like what would it look like if your model were actually doing, you know, something like the brain is doing, and how would you measure that, or, you know,
where's your satisfaction criteria?
I was surprised. I mean, when you were asking, when you were leading the panel debate at the end, Paul, that how many of you feel that you sort of know what success would look like?
Mm. There were about 8 hands that went up.
Just repeat the question.
Yeah, the question was, so it was on a scale of 1 to 10.
Mm.
If you feel, and if you're 8 or higher in terms of feeling that you know what success would look like,
yeah,
then raise your hand.
Yeah. And how many, what fraction of the participants?
Well, there are about 30 here.
Yeah.
So it goes like almost a third, 20, 27. But that's,
I would expect that number to be higher, and that it would rather be that that people had different opinion of what the success would be like.
Well, everyone who did raise their hand did seem to have a different opinion, but I would expect that if people were honest, that it would be about that number.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't raise my hand.
No.
No, yeah. I can't articulate it.
No.
And that's a problem. I know that's a problem. And so this is a good venue to explore that.
So that's true. So that was a little bit surprising for me. I think sort of, that was
maybe. You raised your hand, Gauta.
Maybe because I'm sort of a little bit like an outlier here and participants in terms of I come from this physics side of modeling, and I do sort of like physics type modeling the brain as a physical system. Not that I'm not interested in what the functions are and the other models, but this is, and here the success is sort of a little bit clearer in the sense that you try to mimic sort of physiological data. Or,
that's why you like Stefano's, Andreas' work so much.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So that was sort of, so I think maybe that's, so maybe when you come from physics, the idea of what the success is, whether it's a good idea or not, is, this is more clear, it's more imprinted in us.
Well, and that's why when I drew that awful diagram, it had a lot of different little lobes of success and how those lobes could maybe attach to the different goals from the way people use AI as tools or models and stuff. But Mikko, you also raised your hand, didn't you? When you felt, when I asked that question, don't I remember, you don't have to articulate it, but don't I remember you raising it? Because the question was, do you feel? Can you articulate it? So you're an 8 or above?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That was, yeah. And I mean, that has to do with, you know, what I was doing and thinking about before I started this workshop, because I mean, I was thinking a lot about it before I started the workshop. So, if you would add like a confidence score, you know, as well.
That is the confidence score. That's why it's a 1 to 10.
No, it's a confidence that you know what it would look like, but it's not a confidence of how sure you would, you know, how sure you are that it is actually
achievable. No, that is a different thing.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a different thing, right? I mean, so I know what success would look like. I'm not quite sure.
If it's possible, right? Yeah. I mean, because some of the, I mean, and you could say success would look like us building a perfect brain like that. I mean, no one would argue that that's not success, but
no, I would argue that's impossible. But if you build a perfect brain, then what you're left with is a brain, not necessarily the understanding of its of its functioning, how it works, right?
Sure, but you would you would need to understand, you know, how to build a brain if you were supposed to build, like, I mean, I'm not talking about kind of growing it from, like, you're putting some, you know, genes together, and like that's not, but if you can like build a robotic brain or whatever,
then make a very detailed model, and it's true that would be very hard to understand, but then you could have that as a starting for probing, and it would be the perfect test animal, as we discussed.
But the model has to behave correctly.
Absolutely. So it has to fit the experiments.
Yeah. But it would be like, it would be a if it would be a perfect brand, that would be a success, I think. Like, if you build it, but it wouldn't be like, I mean, that's
the way some people had this idea that it really success would mean that you could make a model of an individual, right? And that's, I mean, the individual brain, like Conrad's brain, right? And so that was like this, and I think that's sort of, that is sort of very, that I don't think is very realistic. I'm thinking more in terms of sort of, like more some kind of average brain, some general properties, and maybe sort of what is the difference between a
healthy brain and maybe like a, you know, like a psychotic brain or like different kinds of brain states and sort of like more like the average kind of. So actually mimicking a particular brain would mean that you need to rewind replay the whole history probably with environmental inputs.
Shouldn't we start with a below average brain like mine though? Isn't that more feasible?
I don't know. It's you know the Tolstoy saying that there's like there's only he never wrote about happy families because it's like a happy family is only happy in the same way. Yeah. There's so many ways to be so unhappy. So maybe that's the same thing that unhealthy brains. There's so many ways to be below average.
Below average. Yeah. Any parting thoughts? Speaking of, we have to leave happy. So, you know, this conference
is happy. How do you want to? This is, has really been a great success. I've talked to people even when you're not there. And they are sort of
that's
all
the,
like,
that's the criteria, exactly. Right? Yeah.
So, and they are extremely, I was so happy and learning. Everything was perfect. So how do you have any? Yeah, do you have any plans for? You don't have to do it well today. Now we are still at the room.
The thing is, you have to keep it kind of small.
Yeah,
for it to be useful. I mean,
I think that was one of the success criteriums. Actually, keeping it small enough that we could become like a small group of friends, basically.
But right? I know what you're going to say. Mm. You're going to say because you said it during the panel that you'd like to have more people from the computer science side.
I think that would be really interesting to see, but I don't know how that would look like though. I mean, it would have to be people from the other side or computer scientists that are genuinely interested in the topic. So it couldn't be like a bunch of people that were just, you know, hoping maybe that can get some cool ideas from neuroscience and just take it and build something, but it would be,
I think that
preferably be someone that wanted to be in the community. That would be really cool.
That's always a challenge, I think. Sort of like you have to sort of, on one hand, you want sort of like a broad set of perspectives. On the other hand, you want sort of like people have some like interface so they actually can sort of communicate, right? So that's sort of a, so if it's too broad, then you're not able to, like, half of the audience doesn't understand what the other half of the audience is talking about, and then it's like difficult to get
there.
That is
difficult.
One thing I really want to say that one thing that I think is really important, and I think has also been a really big part of this success, is to bring people with different backgrounds together. And it's important that they have some, you know, common focus, or else they will just talk by each other. But so if you have like a focus that will, you know, make people think in some parallel or same direction, it's great. So
yeah, and you did that because there are people working on synapses and spiking. There's people working on, you know, Quabeno, neuromorphic essentially. And so you set it up as like the implementation level. There are people at the representation level, the algorithmic level, the computational. So we had. Just a wide variety. Like I said before, I'm repeating myself now, but I think that you achieved that already.
Yeah. And so that's definitely like one of the coolest thing with scientific, interaction or conversation, or like this sociology of bringing together people from different, you know, mindsets and having them talking together. I think like there's some magic that can happen there.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks a lot, Mikkel.
Yeah, thanks again for the invitation.
On behalf of all the participants and on behalf of the field, to be a little bit pompous. Wow. Yeah, exactly.
Pompous. Yeah. Pompous Gauta. That'll be
exactly. That's a new one.
All right. Thanks, Mikkel.
Thank you.
Brain Inspired is powered by The Transmitter, an online publication that aims to deliver useful information, insights, and tools to build bridges across neuroscience and advanced research. Visit thetransmitter.org to explore the latest neuroscience news and perspectives written by journalists and scientists. If you value Brain Inspired, support it through Patreon to access full-length episodes, join our Discord community, and even influence who I invite to the podcast. Go to braininspired.co to learn more. The music you're hearing is Little Wing, performed by Kyle Donovan. Thank you for your support. See you next time.